Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the irradiated. It's just so green, 100% pure plutonium, because we're just opening up all the national parks to mine for it. Of course, my very special guest, speaking about the exploitation of resources, namely human resources, is Kevin Galilee, who is incidentally one of the valuable human resources of the world, who is currently wasting away quite literally. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure being on your show, Vinny, for the third time, might I add. This is our third interview, and I always look forward to being interviewed by you because you're a great host, and of course, your humor is priceless.
Every great host needs a great parasite. Now, wait, did that turn into an insult to you? I meant to insult me. Strike that, reverse it.
I took that as a compliment, actually.
Okay. That's good. We are great parents. In fact, I like to think of myself in the lowest common terms. That way I don't do what every talk radio show host does, take myself too frickin' seriously.
And that way you don't disappoint anybody either.
Including myself. Because, because if you assume you're wrong all the time, ladies and gentlemen, and then you get proven wrong, then you're right. But...
I love your philosophy.
But... if you assume you're wrong all the time and you're proven that, you know, you're actually correct, that you were wrong in the first place, then you're still right.
Now you're starting to confuse me.
Ah, see, this way, it doesn't matter what happens. It's always my fault. And so I don't have to worry about people getting their comeuppance and blame and everything like that. I can blame and punish myself instead.
That's exactly what I'm doing here in Rome, by the way.
Exactly. We blame and we punish ourselves so that we can help other people alleviate their guilt.
Yes.
So
yes, that's a good way of looking at it.
This is your fifth hunger strike, you just told me. When was your first one? By the way, ladies and gentlemen, just to preface the conversation, in case you don't know who Kevin Galilee is, he's a specialist in the depopulation agenda that has been in place since the founding of the UN in, like, what was it, 1945, 46, etc., round about thereabouts. And ever since then, they've been dumbing everybody down and defertilizing pretty much the male sperm and the woman ovum and putting in all sorts of depopulation stuff in many, many different ways to the point where we're all affected by it. Can't escape it, and at this rate, we're going to be dumber than two planks of wood by the end of next century. And some would argue it's already happening.
Yes. This is my fifth hunger strike, and just to put in perspective for your listeners, I'm 48 years old, and my first one happened at the age of 19. Well, at that time, I had just recently arrived in Canada, and I was a landed immigrant, and I was accepted at the University of Victoria to do a bachelor's degree in arts. And I had not received my landed immigrant status, which means that the university was trying to charge me triple tuition fees, which is what they charge foreigners studying in Canada. And I said, no, hold on there. I'm not a foreigner. I'm a resident. It's just because the Canadian government drags its feet with my application, that doesn't mean I'm going to pay a triple tuition fee. So I took a stand, and I went on hunger strike right in front of the City Hall in Victoria, British Columbia. And within 7 days, the government caved in. They sent a person there to say to me, Kevin, you can stop now. We have processed your application. Okay, it's done. Nevertheless, I missed the first semester, but I won the first battle through a hunger strike. And the second one did not happen until 2010. And that was already related to an offshoot of this greater depopulation program. But at that time, of course, I did not know what I was getting myself into. I was only taking on a program of surveillance and censorship. And we discussed that in our previous two interviews, so I don't have to rehash that. But then I did the third hunger strike was in Strasbourg, France. That lasted 30 days. The fourth one was in jail during my second or third arrest, if I remember correctly. The fourth one was in jail again, and that lasted 75 days. It's the longest hunger strike I ever did, and it's a miracle that I survived it. Actually, I don't know how I survived it. But I was in detention as well, pretrial detention, again on false charges as usual, and they put me in a segregation ward, and I was under observation for 24 hours a day, sitting inside a plexiglass cell. So there was no hiding, and they were counting everything, including how many times I was urinating during the day. So there was no way of cheating there. That is recorded, it is chronicled, and anybody who bothers to call the Quinte Detention Center in Ontario, Canada, may be able to obtain the file. And so this is the fifth one now, I'm doing it in Rome, Italy, just 20 minutes walk away from the Vatican, because the Vatican is my target this time. I have tackled, so to say, the secular branch of the New World Order, and now I am taking to task the religious segment of this international order. And the Vatican, naturally, is a very powerful organization. It's been around for 2,000 years, and it has been privy to these secret methods of population control. Since it was accepted, or rather given, observer status at the United Nations. First, it obtained that status at the World Health Organization, which is obviously one of the primary UN agencies in charge of various aspects of the depopulation program, namely adulterating our basic elements of life and finding phony medical justifications for it. That's the duty of the World Health Organization. But the Vatican, having obtained full observer status at the United Nations in 1952 at the World Health Organization, and then a few years later, I think it was 1961, at the headquarters of the United Nations in New York City, it has been, ever since, it has been privy to the methodology employed by the United Nations and governments around the world to subvert our fertility and undermine the family structure, both of which are necessary in order to engineer, or rather carry out, the engineered demographic transition. But because that is how they've decided to defuse the overpopulation bomb, share resources, maintain the peace, and so on. So that's where I am now, here in Rome, 24 days into this hunger strike, and Pope Francis and the Vatican have yet to say a word. I go there every day to St. Peter's Square, which is the large plaza right in front of St. Peter's Basilica, and the Pope can see me from his window because I wear this hand-woven white cotton suit made in India. So I'm very, very visible, and it's, you know, strikingly visible. And I, of course, I'm wearing this on purpose because it has many, many connotations, and because it is visible. And of course, one of the connotations being that Gandhi wore something similar. And Gandhi was perhaps the first human being to have garnered, you know, a very central role in public policy.
Almost as if to say, he's Gandhi, but I'm here now.
Yes. But he wore something like that, and of course he did a lot of hunger strikes, or several hunger strikes. And that was his peaceful way of protesting. And I'm carrying out this tradition. This is a time-honored tradition of peaceful protest. And the reason I'm doing it peacefully, is because I am really giving the authorities, or the elites, if you want to call them that, a last chance to address this and to stop, to address this while we are asking nicely and peacefully. Because I tell you this, if they don't address our complaints, if they don't back off and stop poisoning our children, I will have no choice after this hunger strike is over, and if I survive, and I probably will survive because I'm a pretty tough cookie, I will have no choice but to defend my children by any means possible. And that includes violent resistance. And I will have no hesitation to engage in violent resistance if they continue to poison my children and your children and everybody else's children. We are fully within our right. It is a self-defense. And anybody who commits genocide against us and thinks that they can get away with it just because they hold hands and they lie and they hide between walls of secrecy and deception, they are living a pipe dream, because these very walls that they have built around them to protect themselves and poison us are about to fall on their own heads and bury them alive. And I'm pushing those walls on top of them, and they better move out of the way and get out of our lives.
We always use this term, they, or the New World Order, or the Illuminati, and every now and again you get criticized for what you call these people, right? And we all know who they are and what they are. And I think the only term that actually really is a coverall that kind of covers every base from which you're trying to really communicate is scumbaggery. Because that's ultimately what we're dealing with here, isn't it? It's pure, unadulterated, misfit scumbaggery.
It certainly describes the character of this coalition of the unwilling. I like to call them the coalition of the unwilling, because that is what they are. That is how they came together. That is how they stay together. They're all in it. They are partners in crime. Nobody wants to be in it, but nevertheless, here they are. And they would all love to get out of it, out of the coalition of the unwilling, and I'm giving them now the opportunity to do just that. I'm giving them notice. This is the last notice. They better listen, and they better back off. Anyway, before I proceed with the program tonight, I want to tell our listeners what I intend to discuss. And to put things in perspective, I want to just briefly mention the phases of this depopulation policy, and with the objectives that the international community, or the people in charge of the New World Order wants.
Before we do, could we elucidate on that element about the people that are actually part of the system and are really doing all of these things to humanity as a part, but they don't want to be anymore. And I liken it to getting inducted into a criminal gang as a young man or something of that nature, and you see a lot of crimes being committed by the gang leaders, etc. So if you ever don't want to be part of this gang anymore and you want to go and live a better life, free of pain and suffering and crime and neglect and suffering and all of that kind of stuff, they'll kill you, because you know a whole lot of things that they don't want you ever talking about, and rather than trust you to not open your mouth.
Well, the only people who are fully aware of the program, who have, you know, an overall perspective, are the very people at the top of the United Nations organizations and its various agencies. So the policymakers and the technocrats who have climbed to the very top. Then we have at various national levels, we have the people at the top of the military-industrial complex. But only the very people at the top. All of the others are, you know, in the dark or on a need-to-know basis. They know that they're doing horrible stuff. They know that they're committing crimes. But they only have a very, very sort of narrow understanding of what exactly the overall plan is. Then you have the very top scientists and doctors within the ministries of health and ministries of labor and all kinds of other ministries at the national level in all Western governments, not elsewhere, because most of the countries of the world have been bamboozled into this program. And they have really bought wholesale all of the false medical justifications produced, you know, by the United Nations and by Western scientists and Western institutions and organizations in order to bamboozle countries without the technical and the scientific know-how into believing the lies that they are being fed. And of course, many of the players in these countries, developing nations, who lack the technical skills and the scientific knowledge, they, you know, they like it that way because they don't have to carry the full burden of their consciences. They too have an inkling that what they're doing is genocide, but they don't exactly know how or why, and they justify it by saying, well, this is an international security prerogative, this is in the hands of the United Nations, and if we didn't do it, then we would have to resort to war. And this is better than war. So, in fact, we are preserving the peace. Therefore, at whatever cost, it's better than all-out war or nuclear war or conventional war. So, what we're doing is actually a good thing. It's the lesser evil for the greater good. And yes, there is some truth to that. But
you know, this reminds me of C.S. Lewis quote. Of all tyrannies, one that is perpetrated for the good of its victims is by far the most tyrannical, because those who oppress you will do so without end, with the consistent belief that what they're doing is the right thing.
Yes, that is why these kinds of crimes are so difficult to stop. They are so difficult to stop as they require that the people who are fighting this system, people like us, have to be more persuasive than they are. And of course, we are hampered in our attempt to persuade the public of what is happening by the walls of deception, by the media silence, the mainstream media, who, by the way, is fully complicit in mass murder and crimes against humanity. And one day, and I'm giving this bitter warning to the people in the mainstream media who think that they've secured themselves a safe place in the New World Order and that their families are going to survive into the future while ours are being annihilated. I'm giving them a fair warning now that unless they start doing their jobs, they are going to end up in prison for the rest of their lives for their complicity in crimes against humanity. So they are now quietly sitting on the sidelines and pretending that this is not happening, because that is how the system works. It's all a pretense. And they think that as long as all of these people and institutions and organizations and countries hold hands and they all deny, that they can get away with denial. Well, that was possible until about 2 years ago when I published my first book and exposed this policy to the fullest. That is no longer possible now. Over the past 2 years, we have made huge progress in convincing the public that what we say is correct, and that our governments are not to be trusted. And now the trust has been broken. And when the trust has been broken between the governed and the governing people, this trust cannot be recovered unless the governing class is completely replaced. We are going to replace them down to the last one, because none of them is to be trusted, and all of them have have betrayed us and have therefore lost the right to govern. They have broken the social contract, and that is an unforgivable crime. Their reign of power has become illegitimate. You cannot govern unless you are a legitimate government, and you cannot be legitimate if you are an illegal and criminal government. And we are having a criminal government and a criminal international superstructure. Yes, I know the reasons why, and I know the desperate situation they are in, but they no longer have the excuse that, let's say, the administrations of the 60s, 70s, and almost up to the 80s had. Those excuses are gone. The world is a completely different place now, and everything, all the tools necessary are in place to change course, to change from covert methods, from hidden methods of population control, to overt methods, to open methods of population control.
So we're talking about a transition from deliberately poisoning everybody without their knowledge and having unforeseen consequences to people actually realizing how to control their own fertility and things of that nature and just do it to themselves.
Yes, people can merely use contraceptives, you know, faithfully.
And we're only talking about population here, like. But then again, there's abortions and this kind of thing. These are quote unquote terrible but necessary steps, according to the globalists. Oh wait, in fact, I don't even think it's that terrible.
Yes, if we use contraceptives faithfully and carefully, we don't have to engage in horrible things like abortion. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I detest the notion of having to abort my child. And if I won't do it, then I wouldn't expect anybody else to do it. But the technology of birth prevention now is very, very advanced. I mean, we have a gazillion different kinds of contraceptives. All we need now is for the religious authorities to move out of the way, to get out of the way, and encourage the use of contraceptives, so we don't have to be poisoned secretly into extinction.
Here's
so
the problem, though. A lot of those contraceptives secretly poison people.
Yeah, but right now they're doing that because they are they still pursue this plan through.
They're not talking about birth control. They're talking about sterilization.
Yes, that's what they're doing to us now. And of course, when you attack one of the most important, the most deeply rooted physiological functions of the human body, which is the ability to procreate our reproductive systems, and then it's impossible not to damage the entire human organism. And that's what they're doing. They're damaging our entire endocrine system because these poisons that they feed us are endocrine disruptors. And even though that was not their intended consequence at any time, this is nevertheless what is happening. And this health damage to our health is cumulative. It gets worse and worse from every generation.
Yeah, dumber and sicker by the day.
Yes, if time allows, I'm going to discuss, in some detail medical damage. But yes, the damage that they are doing to us is terrible, and it threatens the very existence of the majority of the world's genetic lineages. In other words, our survival is being jeopardized. But now let me put this in perspective. This policy is huge, and it didn't start overnight. Most people are under the false impression that this is something that just started maybe 10 years ago or so, and they don't realize that this is a multi-generational effort. So I'm going to describe now the phases of depopulation. I'm going to describe when it started, what the objectives are of these three phases, because there are three phases involved, and where they're heading with this. Now, because this plan involves the entire world, the sheer magnitude of the global depopulation policy has dictated a gradual and incremental approach that has three distinct phases. And each one of these phases has a primary objective. Phase one, I call it a population control phase, started immediately after the war in 1945. But for most countries, around 1950, because it took the United Nations a few years to get its act together and for the major allied powers to agree on how to pursue this. So from 1950 to 2000, we have this this phase one. It has lasted half a century. And the overarching goal of the depopulation lobby during this phase has been to bring the total fertility rate, the so-called TFR, of every country on Earth down to just 2 children per woman, the so-called replacement level fertility. That means if every couple has 2 kids, then the population neither grows nor decreases, and it stays stable for all times, and therefore countries can live within their means, and there's no need for war. That's the rationale. The rationale is sound and simple. And they've basically accomplished this goal, with the exception of a few countries in Africa.
Oh, I've got a better idea already. Yes. Okay. If you want to prevent war and make it not possible to happen, outlaw financing both sides and enforce it. Pa-ding! No more major wars.
It's funny you say that, because I'm going to discuss the importance of monetary coercion, of the economic aspect of this, right after I talk about the phases of the population.
Proceeds.
To move on to phase two. So phase one has been basically a success. They've accomplished this. The total fertility rate in most countries on Earth is now below replacement level, with the exception of a few countries in sub-Saharan Africa. You have a couple of countries in Latin America and a couple of countries in Asia. But more or less, it's a done deal. Phase two, the population stabilization phase. And that started in the year 2000, so at the beginning of this century. And it is going to go on till about 2040, or at the latest, the middle of the century. And the overarching goal of this phase is to ensure that the global population does not exceed 9 billion, or at the most 10 billion, and that it peaks by 2040, or at the latest by 2050. And that's they deem this necessary because the existing landmass and our technology for growing food does not allow us to feed more than that. And to make sure that this happens, that they stop the global population dead in its track, and it starts reversing from then on. They've fully unleashed GMOs, genetically modified organisms, on the developing world and on the nations of the Middle East and the Gulf of Arabia, to ensure that the goal is reached, that the goal of keeping their fertility low is reached. At the same time, they have unleashed chemtrails on the population of the developed world to make sure that the baby boom generation, which has started retiring 5 years ago or so, that their lifespans are shortened, because during this this phase, this demographic phase, we have now in Western countries and in the developing world, we have a population pyramid where there are more old people than there are young people. So there's not enough workers to sustain this this retired population, and they're crushing all of the social system. So they can't allow the baby boomers to live, you know, for 30, 40 years in retirement. So they're making sure that their lifespans are shortened. That's how desperate the situation is.
It seems to me that none of these people are in control who came up with this plan were raised properly and were never read the story. The woman who swallowed the spider to catch the fly that she'd already swallowed. You know, you just wind up making things worse by trying to control things. You know? In fact, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show .com, sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in Newland and Auckland there, and Blue Shield, as well as a couple of books. The Crowdfunding Revolution is one of them. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.
Oh, oppression, you prey on us when we sleep. Oppression, you chase after the tired or the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression, you reach out with your long arm. But oppression, I won't let you near me. Ah, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression, you seek population control. Oppression, to divide and to conquer is your goal. Oppression.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee. Now, I was talking before the break about how we had these unintended consequences, I call them. So like an onion, there's various layers of consequences that are all unintended. And it occurs to me that it's kind of like a snowball effect, like things are getting crazier and worse. And I think this is because you have, as an elected official who has lots of secrets and covert methods of administering your power, you get a lot of it. And in so doing, just like every major dictator throughout history, has gone completely nuts.
Yes, and there's actually a bit more to it than that. You see, they're in a very, very desperate situation, and they're just trying to stay one step ahead of disaster. They're trying to prevent, to preempt disaster. And this is how they manage in justifying these actions, which amount to genocide, by saying, and actually truthfully so, they are preempting even worse. But of course, nobody could foresee in 1945 what would be necessary down the road, 50 years, 60 years down the road, once you've triggered this demographic transition. And this demographic transition, of course, is the attempt to make sure that the population stabilizes, then it reverses and down to a sustainable level. And it's like the best analogy is like forcing a river to flow backwards, because it is a completely unnatural process. And this is why we see now that everything that governments do and the international community does is it makes absolutely no sense if their function would truly be, you know, to aid us, to help us, to make sure that all, to ensure our welfare and our well-being. Of course, that is not what they're doing. What they're doing is they're trying to force this river, the river of humanity, backwards, you know, back to a sustainable population, from a growing population, which is a natural population, to a shrinking population, which is obviously a completely unnatural process. So I was in the middle of describing phase two, the population stabilization phase, which is scheduled to last 50 years as well, from the year 2000 to the middle of this century. This is a critical period because we are being bombarded now from all directions with covert chemical and biological poisons, and of course subverted with psychosocial and economic methods. So we are under sustained attack from every direction. This is also a critical period because fertility rates in the poorest of nations are dropping like raindrops from the sky without being accompanied by prosperity. And prosperity was always used to justify falling birth rates in order to conceal the true reasons for their decline. And this is raising suspicions worldwide. And, you know, many of the demographers are scratching their heads and saying, how the heck is this happening? Those who know, they obviously won't say a word about it until I put it all together and explain it for the world to see.
Yeah.
So now phase three, the controlled depopulation phase, that is going to start around 2040 or 2050, provided that the goal of ensuring the population peaks is reached. And once the population peaks at 9 billion, the full panoply of fertility depressing agents and poisons that we're now bombarded with will remain in place to ensure a steady and controlled decline. Now, how low the population will have to decrease will be dictated by our consumption patterns by our environmental necessities. But judging by how fast the developing world is aspiring to reach Western standards of living, and of course everybody wants to live better and better, everybody wants to reach, you know, Western standards of living, and judging how fast the fossil fuels and freshwater resources are being depleted, it is safe to assume that the global population will have to shrink by at least two-thirds from its peak of 9 billion, so down to about 3 billion. Provided, and this is a big if, provided that renewable energy technologies will be fully engaged in the next 50 years, and provided that the carbon footprint of every human being on the planet decreases to half of what it is today. And it's particularly important that the carbon footprint of Westerners decreases to half of what it is today, because we are the biggest consumers. Now, in the absence of these two accomplishments and of such sparing use of resources and universal use of advanced technology, the population will have to decrease to less than 1 billion if human civilization can halt the destruction of the environment on which its very survival depends. So these are, you know, there's a lot of open questions there, and they're going to act accordingly, depending what the circumstances
will,
are. Technology is.
Will life extension technology exist for the people who can afford it?
Well, that's the last thing they want. What they want is to shorten the lifespans of the baby boomers and not to lengthen them. Once the population is stabilized at the desired level, and it is sustainable, let's say by 2150, and I should have said, yes, I forgot to mention that this third phase will last about 100 years from 2050 to about 2150. So by that time, let's say the population is stable, it's down to about 3 billion or down to a billion, depending on our, as I said, on our consumption patterns and technology. And then they can contemplate, you know, long lifespans. For the time being, that's the exact absolute opposite of what they want. That would be a curse. That would be completely contrary to their desperate program of, you know, of saving civilization and saving the Mother Earth, on which our civilization depends. That's the plan, and it has been pursued, you know, with a great cost in human effort and money. And it is a miracle that they have been able to keep it quiet for this long. That tells you just how much effort they put into this and how few people actually are privy to the entire plan. Because most people are just, you know, cogwheels in this huge international system that has probably a couple of million participants.
I've been debating chemtrails a bit on the internet lately with some people, and one of their arguments was it was impossible for chemtrails to happen because too many people would have to be involved. Well, think about how many people are involved in the general depopulation agenda, and it's only just coming out now, and it's been running for like near on half a century, mate. Okay, all right, trust me, it's more than possible.
And, you know, I'm not even going to regale the cynics with that kind of idiotic questions. It's happening, it's real, it's here, so you accept it.
They believe that as if you're a KFC frontline employee, that you get given the Colonel's secret recipe the first day on the job. Okay, that's what they believe, tantamount, isn't it? They don't give you secrets when you're on the ground floor, mate. Nobody who works for Greenpeace knows what the frickin' top person in Greenpeace is really thinking about or doing, you know? He, if he's out collecting donations from unsuspecting hippies and things of that nature, do you think he knows how to run the entire global organization with copious quantities of resources and contacts and history about it and all of that kind of stuff? No! There's something deeper going on in anything that has a major public face. And if you don't know what it is, try and shut up for a second and learn from some of the people who claim that they do.
Listen, I have no sympathy and no patience anymore for the doubters and the cynics and the, you know, the idiots who won't accept the facts and don't have the courage to stare reality in the face because they're too invested in the system. I'm not going to waste my time with them. They are going to disappear from the face of the earth if they don't listen and read and know how to defend their families, because for the time being, all we can do is, you know, sort of mitigate the damage done to our children until such time as we throw these criminals out of out of power and we take over and we take responsibility over the depopulation program. Because if we take the criminals out of power and we don't take over the responsibility over the depopulation program, we think that God is going to solve our problems or Christ is going to come back for the second time and magically solve our problems, then we're dreaming. Then we might as well leave them in place, leave the criminals in place in power today, because we'd be better off than taking over and doing nothing. Yeah. That's how crucial this, you know, this is. But something that's interesting that I should mention about chemtrails and not this, you know, this doubting nonsense is the following. The use of chemtrails, which, you know, poisons the air, it just shows you that it's in a sense their attempt to democratize death, premature death, because they themselves cannot protect themselves from the poisoning that comes from the air. They have to breathe this air too. And that is how they show the world. Eventually, they will be able to explain, you know, their crimes to the world. They're going to say, "Well, we have subjected ourselves to the exact same methods. We too are breathing the air. Okay, we have not done anything to you that we're not doing to ourselves, because that's how desperate the situation is. Okay, we are all our generation now, that is the baby boom generation. That is, well, the generation before us. Because I'm not a baby boomer. I'm only 48." Who have basically, you know, been involved in this program from the very beginning, or almost from the very beginning, are subjecting themselves to the exact same medicine, because they know that the only way to justify mass murder is if you, even though you are in the know, if you are at the receiving end of the same methods. They know one of these days. This is going to be public knowledge. This is going to be investigated. It is going to be in front of tribunals, and they will have to explain to the world why they've done this. So this will enable them to say, and truthfully so, that, listen, we have not done anything to you that we're not doing to ourselves, because that's how desperate the situation is. So this is the important aspect of chemtrails, not this nonsense denial.
It's interesting. Because that's one of the very reasons why the deniers say that chemtrails don't exist, because why would somebody do that to themselves?
Because these people are not psychopathic murderers per se. What they are desperate policymakers who are saying, if we don't do this, it's going to be even worse. And they've withheld this because they didn't want the population, the general population, to have to face this kind of a decision. Can you imagine if they would have put this to a vote? They would have gone, you know, on CNN and Al Jazeera and all of these mega media channels and said to the world, "Listen, folks, this is what we have to do. We have to poison our air because we have to shorten our lifestyles. Otherwise, the whole social system, social structure, is going to crumble. So can we have a vote? Can we have your approval? Are you okay with this? Do you think that the general population, who doesn't understand dick about, you know, about demographics and about politics and about geopolitics and about the desperate situation of resource scarcity, do you think that they would have said, and of course we also have, you know, half the population who is illiterate, so they would have said, yeah, sure, go ahead, what the heck, go ahead, poison us. No. It takes a tremendous amount of knowledge, first of all, a tremendous amount of foresight, because you have to look into the future. And for the first time, you know, the humankind, the human race, the species, our species, has proceeded into the future by thinking, you know, 100, 200 years ahead and acting accordingly. And not only thinking, you know, generations ahead, with the well-being of generations that are yet to be born in mind, but also with the well-being of the earth that sustains us in mind. Because for the first time, the social construct that we have built from scratch, and that is, you know, wholly independent of Mother Nature, and it is entirely of our own making, for the first time, we have to subject it to a set of rules that considers the environment, considers the planet, considers the future, considers the yet-to-be-born generations. Yeah, this is a leap into a completely different kind of policymaking and ethos. That's why it is so difficult. That's why they didn't trust us with this knowledge. They thought, you know, the common man is just too ignorant and too caught up in his or her own little world to understand.
Well,
you know?
well, as opposed to analyzing themselves as saying, hey, maybe we're completely selfish and self-absorbed and completely irresponsible, and we don't actually really care about these people at all, and what we want to do is maintain our standard of living the way we want it, as opposed to letting the chips fall where they may. We want to maintain control of society like our generations previous have done so. It's kind, kind of like a royal bloodline.
But Vinny, the reality is that whoever is in control, somebody has to be in control within a social system, because we live in society. We don't live, you know, under natural law.
I don't think somebody has to be in control per se. There has to be a middle ground or an equality there between those people who are doing the governing and those who are being governed, to be kept in the loop, sort of thing.
But it's only possible now, because now we have the technology necessary to disseminate information rapidly and cheaply, almost free of cost.
Exactly. So they could technically abandon all of this stuff and de-phase it out, you know, over a couple of decades or so, and gradually inform people about how to get stuff done using the technological developments and abilities that we have to enhance a direct form of democracy where people participate in their own demise rather than having it planned for them without their consent.
You're perfectly correct, and this is exactly where the world is heading, because now the secret is out, and a secret policy cannot proceed without the cover of secrecy. But what I want to talk next about is something that, you know, many people have scratched their heads over, because they can't understand how this depopulation program fits in with the globalization program. And the two of them, of course, are, you can't split them apart. It's like white on rice. One belongs to the other. You can't separate the two. And it's a very complex way in which these two major goals interact. And if you give me the time, I'm going to start explaining, you know, step by step, how this relationship works, the globalization depopulation relationship, which is the axis around which the global community and peace and stability in the world have been maintained since 1945, and which is why they're so reluctant to let go of this.
Considering the United States has invaded like 52 countries since it declared peace in World War II, I'm not 100% sure if things have been entirely peaceful since then, but continue.
No, but we have avoided another world war, and we have avoided nuclear.
But what do you call the world war on terrorism other than a world war by proxy?
Yes, but just imagine, compare this with the sheer destruction and violence of the Second World War, of the First World War.
Which was financed by the same bankers who are implementing the global depopulation agenda. I think it's more like a one-step, two-step, three-step program rather than, we made that mistake, let's do something different now.
No, you know, you're assuming that the leaders of the world and of countries have had full control. It's impossible to have the world under control. Even now, today, with the power and might of the United States of America, and with the international infrastructure that the United Nations has spanned across the globe, even now they cannot control the world. The world is uncontrollable. It's very difficult.
That's not true. Rothschild famous family quote, "Give me control of a nation's money supply and I care not who makes its laws." It's totally possible to control the world if you control the money supply of the entire world. We have the World Bank, IMF, Bank of England, Federal Reserve, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, all the countries of the world with the exception of North Korea and Iran, and used to be Libya, have Rothschild-owned private central banks who control what policy gets implemented. This is the reason why your depopulation agenda that you've discovered has been able to be put into play, because it's been financed by somebody globally.
I'm glad that you mentioned the Rothschilds and the banking system, because this is where I was going, and I'm going to shatter that myth. The one myth that needs to be shattered is that bankers are in control of the world. And let me start explaining, but you have to give me the leeway to explain this, because it is not an easy explanation. Okay?
I'm going to have to give you quite some time for this, actually. Yeah, we've only got 7 minutes until the end of the segment. Is that going to be enough?
No, but we can continue after in the next segment. Okay.
Proceed.
I want to show that the banking system is actually beholden to political decision makers who are using the power of money or monetary coercion to advance by proxy an ancient dream, the dream of a united world, which is a political goal and a worthy one. Now, having learned from history that international peace and security cannot be gained by conquest, and the two world wars are, you know, were the hard lessons learned in this process, that it cannot be gained by conquest, thus by military means, policymakers since the end of the world of World War II have employed fiscal means to force the world into peaceful cooperation and coexistence. So monetary coercion has replaced military force as the method by which to secure global peace and prosperity, which are the fundamental prerequisites of a one world order. The Europeans, prior to this, you know, mode of thinking and acting on the international stage, they just went around the world and took by force whatever the heck they wanted. That's why they built their colonial systems and so on. So let us get started by going back in time when the political decision was made to put in place a set of rules and the institutions necessary to enforce them, to ensure that nations refrain from taking what is not rightfully theirs. And instead of taking what is not rightfully theirs, engage in peaceful trade with other nations to obtain the natural resources they need to industrialize and to prosper. And that time is 1944, just before the end of the Second World War. And the place is Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And this is where the Bretton Woods organizations were formed, and of course the United Nations is one. The World Bank and the IMF are the others. Now, at Bretton Woods, what they did is they negotiated a monetary order, and they set it in place. And this monetary order was to govern commercial and financial relations among the 44 independent nation states that participated at that time. At that time, the founding members of the United Nations were just 44 nations, not 193 like now. So this new monetary order that was set in place to govern commercial and financial relations in order to avoid wars of necessity over resources obligated every country to adopt a monetary policy that tied every currency in the world to the U.S. dollar, and also enable it to maintain the exchange rates and to empower the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which was a newly formed institution, to bridge any temporary imbalances of payments. Because in the past, they had run into trouble. Whenever there was trade between nations, sometimes nations wouldn't, the debtors would not pay the debt, and of course, that led to conflict. So they did not want to repeat that. They had to find a way in which to make international trade or trade between nations as fully functional, as smoothly functional as, let's say, going to your local market to purchase tomatoes and potatoes. So it was by this political decision, order was made from the chaos that previously reigned on the international arena with respect to how nations access vital resources that are found outside their territories, not inside. And when nations start industrializing, and that's what happened towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, all of these Western nations were rapidly industrializing, and they were fighting for the same resources. They wanted access to oil and coal and steel and metals and so on. So by ensuring that everyone pays for the resources they need rather than take them by force, as was previously the case, the European model that led to two world wars, peace was secured. And to be able to pay for resources that rather than take them by force, a system was created to recognize the value of each national currency and to facilitate trade between nations by allowing international financial transactions to take place as orderly and as smoothly as national financial transactions. So that's what Bretton Woods accomplished. It was the first and most important step towards an integrated global economy. And ever since that time, the economic aspect of the international community, of this new world order, has become far more important than the military aspect of it.
And even more than that, since the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act, they've become even more powerful.
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, let me continue with the history of this because it's extraordinarily interesting, you know, and it will remove so many misconceptions. It will make people, it will enable people, our listeners, to put things in perspective, to know how this has evolved, how this plan has evolved.
And we will continue doing that just after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Galilee is my very special guest. Back in a minute.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?